Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. I'm going to read the major news articles from the Monday, August 4th, 2025 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's find out what kind of weather is in store for us. First, there's a current alert, extreme heat warning until Friday, 8 p.m. For today's weather, abundant sunshine near record high temperatures, highs to 108 degrees Fahrenheit, winds west at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight's forecast, a few clouds, lows 82 degrees Fahrenheit, winds southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow's forecast predicts sunshine and clouds mixed, near record high temperatures, highs to 108 degrees Fahrenheit, northeast winds shifting to west-northwest at 10 to 20 miles per hour. We'll begin with the reading of the first article of the Arizona Daily Star front page titled, Tensions Rise Amid Officials' Jerusalem Prayer Visit. This article was written by Wafa Sharafa, Sam Metz, and Sammy Magdi of the Associated Press, dateline Deir al-Balah Gaza Strip. A far-right Israeli minister visited and prayed at Jerusalem's most sensitive holy site on Sunday, triggering regional condemnation and fears that the provocative move could further escalate tensions. The visit came as hospitals in Gaza said 33 more Palestinians seeking food aid were killed by Israeli gunfire. With Israel facing global criticism over famine-like conditions in the besieged strip, Itamar Ben-Gvir's visit to the hillside compound threatened to further set back efforts by international mediators to halt Israel's nearly two-year military offensive in Gaza. The area which Jews call the Temple Mount is the holiest site in Judaism and was home to the ancient biblical temples. Muslims call the site the Noble Sanctuary. Today it is home to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site in Islam. Visits to the site by Israeli officials are considered a provocation across the Muslim world, and openly praying violates a long-standing status quo. Jews have been allowed to tour it, but are barred from praying with Israeli police and troops providing security. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said after Ben-Gvir's visit that Israel would not change the norms governing the site. Ben-Gvir visited following Hamas' release of videos showing two emaciated Israeli hostages. The videos caused an uproar in Israel and raised pressure on the government to reach a deal to bring home the remaining 50 hostages who were captured on October 7, 2023, in the Hamas-led attack that triggered the war. Ben-Gvir called for Israel to annex the Gaza Strip and encourage Palestinians to leave, reviving rhetoric that has complicated negotiations to end the war. He raged against the video that Hamas released Saturday of 24-year-old hostage Ivatar David showing him emaciated in a dimly lit Gaza tunnel and called it an attempt to pressure Israel. Ben-Gvir's previous visits to the site have prompted threats from Palestinian militant groups. Clashes between Israeli security forces and Palestinian demonstrators in and around the site fueled an 11-day war with Hamas in 2021. Sunday's visit was swiftly condemned as an incitement by Palestinian leaders, as well as Jordan and Al-Aqsa Mosque custodian, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. The Houthi rebels in Yemen said they fired three drones at Israel. Israeli military said a suspicious aerial target launched from Yemen was intercepted. The videos released by Hamas and Islamic Jihad, the second largest militant group in Gaza, triggered outrage across the political spectrum after the hostages, speaking under duress, described grim conditions and an urgent lack of food. Tens of thousands rallied in Tel Aviv on Saturday, calling on Israel and the United States to urgently pursue the hostages' release after suspending ceasefire talks. Israel's mission to the UN said it requested an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council on the hostages, which will take place Tuesday. They do not want a deal, Netanyahu said of Hamas. They want to break us using these videos of horror. His office said it spoke with the Red Cross to seek help in providing the hostages with food and medical care. The International Committee of the Red Cross said it was appalled by the harrowing videos and called for access to the hostages. Hamas military wing said it was ready to respond positively to Red Cross requests to deliver food to hostages if humanitarian corridors are opened in a regular and permanent manner in Gaza. Right-wing politicians who opposed deals with Hamas said the videos reinforced their conviction that Hamas must be obliterated. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society said a staff member was killed when Israeli forces shelled its office. Israel's military said it was reviewing the claim. The Red Cross called it an outrage that so many first responders have been killed in the war. Hospital officials said Israeli forces killed at least 33 Palestinians seeking food Sunday, and witnesses described facing gunfire as hungry crowds surged towards aid sites. Desperation has gripped the Palestinian territory of more than 2 million, which experts warn faces a worst-case scenario of famine because of Israel's blockade. No aid entered Gaza between March 2nd and May 19th, and aid has been limited since then. Witness Youssef Abed described coming under the indiscriminate fire and seeing at least 3 people bleeding on the ground. "I couldn't stop and help them because of the bullets," he said. 2 hospitals in southern and central Gaza reported receiving bodies from routes leading to the Israeli-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation aid sites, including 11 killed in the Taina area while trying to reach a distribution point in Khan Yunis. 3 Palestinian eyewitnesses, including one traveling through Taina, told the Associated Press they saw soldiers open fire on the routes, which are in military zones secured by Israeli forces. Israel's military said it was not aware of casualties as a result of its gunfire near aid sites. GHF's media office said there was no gunfire near or at our sites. The United Nations says 859 people were killed near GHF sites from May 27th to July 31st, and hundreds of others have been killed along the routes of UN-led food convoys. GHF says its armed contractors have only used pepper spray or fired warning shots to prevent deadly crowding. Israel's military has said it only fires warning shots. Both claim the death tolls have been exaggerated. The title of the next front page article is "Ruling Backs Blocking Projects." This article was written by Bob Christie of Capital Media Services. A small town fight over a plan to overhaul a downtown area that has made its way all the way to the Arizona Supreme Court has led to a new ruling making it much easier for residents across the state to block locally approved projects at the ballot box. Residents of Arizona, cities, towns, and counties have the absolute right to propose their own laws even if elected officials have already decided on a redevelopment plan and told one their government departments to implement it. The ruling issued last week. The decision could lead to local governments across Arizona having their decisions on roadway widenings, redesigns, and other projects vetoed by voters at the ballot box. In this case, some residents in the small northern Arizona city of Page organized to oppose a plan approved by the city council to remake a 1.4-mile section of downtown to boost business activity. The downtown Page streetscape project involved removing 2 of the 4 travel lanes on Lake Powell Boulevard through the city's business district, adding parking and wider sidewalks as a place to draw tourists and locals for dining and events. The center turn lane would remain. The city rejected a ballot measure proposed by local citizens that would block the road widening, saying it was administrative and not subject to the initiative process in the Arizona Constitution. A trial court judge and the Arizona Court of Appeals, in an opinion written by Justice Maria Elena Cruz before she joined the High Court in January, sided with the city. But the Supreme Court overturned those rulings, saying that the initiative was legislative in nature and that the power of citizens to propose their own laws applied. Cruz recused herself and did not participate in the new decision. The foundational principle that informs this case is that the people's power to make laws is co-equal to their elected representatives' authority to create legislation, Justice Clint Bullock wrote for the unanimous Supreme Court. He said the initiative was legislative and backers had the right to propose it. The initiative expressly creates public policy, preserving Lake Powell Boulevard as it existed on October 1, 2023, and the means of accomplishing that policy, preventing the use of public funds to narrow the specified portion of the road, Bullock wrote for the unanimous Supreme Court. The fact that this represents, or rather, the fact that this reflects a change in public policy does not alter its legislative character. The High Court ordered the initiative put before voters, but did not set an election date. The decision concerns Nancy Davidson, General Counsel for the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. She said that at any given time there are hundreds of roadway projects underway across the state, many of them involving multiple cities and requiring coordination between planners, traffic analysts, utilities, contractors, and more. She said the court decision classifying decisions about them legislative rather than the administrative as they always have been, appears to make them vulnerable to challenges. Are we opening it up? And I think we are, where we're allowing street projects to be basically second-guessed by the electorate every single time. Davidson said, it could just really wreak havoc on any type of infrastructure planning, especially now that we're going through so much growth. The plan was developed over nearly 8 years, and little opposition developed until the new group emerged after this council had approved the project, said Bill Dyack, who served as mayor for 14 years before deciding not to seek re-election last year. It was prompted in large by the 2019 shutdown of the coal-fired Navajo generating station near Page and the Kayenta mine that supplied it with coal, said Dyack, an 80-year-old retired power plant employee. More than 500 high-paying jobs at the power plant alone were eliminated. The loss of the major regional employees led the council to refocus on tourism and kickstarted the streetscape project, Dyack said. The city was awarded a $5 million federal grant last year to pay for the makeover and set aside more than $5 million in city funds as well. You know, we used to have an industrial environment, high-paying jobs, and fully pensioned, Dyack said. We had a coal mine and a power plant. In 2019, all that changed. We lost all of those high-paying jobs and everything, and we switched over to where our economy is now, tourism. Since then, the small-town political fight led to major changes in the council's makeup, hard feelings on both sides, and fears by Dyack that the damage will be felt for years. Deborah Roundtree, who with her veterinarian husband ran an animal hospital in town and organized the Page Action Committee to fight the streetscape project, agreed that hard feelings prevailed from the battle she led. She's still angry at what she said were lies and deceit by the council and backers of the plan, and she said she's been harassed and intimidated. I've had my home security challenged. I can't tell you the level of what individuals did to try to keep the citizens from being allowed to vote, Roundtree said. I mean, that's the funny thing about this, right? Citizens have to vote, and they might vote in favor of it, we don't know. She complained about an anonymous letter that circulated, including among the council criticizing her. And she said, spoke of rumors she can't prove, that there were people poised to cash in on the redevelopment plan. I have no idea why our past council believed that reducing Lake Powell Boulevard down to two lanes would cause us to have an economic increase, she said. Although she's opposed to the cost, her main complaint is that the plan would eliminate traffic lanes, saying it could lead to gridlock through town as RVs, pickups, hauling boats to the lake, and tourist buses try to navigate the tighter street. Dyack, a resident since 1980, says Roundtree has no one but herself to blame and said she ginned up unfounded allegations against the council. She stirred the pot. She stirred the pot, and in order to do that, she had to discredit counsel, Dyack said. So wherever she got an opportunity to do that, she did. And then when it came down to the nitty-gritty, she backed off of that. As with most small-town political fights, it's hard to weigh who's right or wrong. The title of the next front page article is Medicaid Under Threat, 60 Years After Creation. This article was written by Lisa Mascaro of the Associated Press, Dateline Washington. On July 30, 1965, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed legislation that launched Medicaid, creating a U.S. healthcare safety net for millions of low-income Americans, a crowning achievement of his domestic legacy. A year earlier, he did the same for food stamps, drawing on President John F. Kennedy's first executive order for the development of a positive food and nutrition program for all Americans. This summer, President Donald Trump began to chisel away at the programs. The Republican Party's big tax and spending law delivered not just $4.5 trillion in tax breaks for Americans, but some of the most substantial changes to the landmark safety net programs in their history. The trade-off will cut more than $1 trillion over a decade from federal health care and food assistance, largely by imposing work requirements on those receiving aid and by shifting certain federal costs to the states. While Republicans argue the trims are needed to right-size the federal programs that grew over the decades and prevent rising federal deficits, they also seek to shrink the federal government and the services it provides. Polling shows most U.S. adults don't think the government is overspending on those programs. Americans broadly support increasing or maintaining existing levels of funding for popular safety net programs, including Social Security and Medicare, according to the poll from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. Local governments are scrambling to figure out how they will comply with the new landscape, calculating whether they will need to raise their own taxes to cover costs, trim budgets elsewhere, or cut back aid. The cuts are really big, they are really broad, and they are deeply damaging, said Sharon Parrott, president of the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, a research institute in Washington. The consequences are millions of people losing health care coverage, she said. Millions of people losing food assistance, and the net result of that is higher poverty, more hardship. At the same time, certain people who receive aid, including parents of teenagers and older Americans up to age 64, will have to work, take classes, or do community service for 80 hours a month to meet new requirements. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates 10 million more people will end up without health insurance. About 3 million fewer people will participate in the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program known as SNAP. People are really concerned what this means for their fiscal health, said Mark Ritacco, Chief Government Affairs Officer at the National Association of Counties, which held its annual conference the week after Trump signed the bill. The organization pushed senators to delay the start dates for some Medicaid changes, and it hopes further conversation with lawmakers in Congress can prevent some of them from ever taking hold. We're talking about Medicare and SNAP. These are people's lives and livelihoods, Ritacco said. When President Johnson established Medicaid alongside Medicare, the health care program for seniors as part of the Social Security amendments of 1965, it was meant for low-income families as well as the disabled. Nearly every state signed on to participate in Medicaid by 1970, according to KFF, an organization focused on health policy. The program soon expanded to include pregnant women, school-aged children, and not just the very poor, but also those with incomes just over the federal government poverty limit, which is now about $15,650 annually for a single person and $26,650 for a family of three. In the 15 years since the Affordable Care Act became law under President Barack Obama, Medicaid grew substantially as most states opted to join the federal expansion. About 80 million adults and children are covered. While the uninsured population tumbled, the federal cost of providing Medicaid soared to more than $880 billion a year. The next front page article is titled COVID-19 Cases, Visits to Emergency Rooms Rise. This article was written by Devi Shastri of the Associated Press. Summer heat, outdoor fun, and cold and flu symptoms? The three may not go together in many people's minds, partly owing to common myths about germs and partly because many viruses really do have low activity levels in the summer. But it is possible to get the sniffles or worse in the summer. Federal data released Friday, for example, shows COVID-19 is trending up in many parts of the country, with emergency departments visits up among people of all ages. Here's what to know about summer viruses. Question: are colds and flus circulating right now? Answer: the number of people seeking medical care for three key illnesses, COVID-19, flu, and respiratory cyclical virus, or RSV, is currently low, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Flu is trending down and RSV was steady this week, but COVID-19 is trending up in many mid-Atlantic, southeast, southern, and west coast states. The expectation is that COVID-19 will eventually settle into a winter seasonal pattern like other coronaviruses. But the past few years have brought a late summer surge, said Dr. Dean Bloomberg, chief of pediatric infectious diseases at University of California, Davis Children's Hospital. Other viruses circulating this time of year include the one that causes hand, foot, and mouth disease, which has symptoms similar to a cold, plus sores and rashes, and norovirus, sometimes called the stomach flu. Question: do viruses spread less in the summer? Answer: many viruses circulate seasonally, picking up as the weather cools in the fall and winter. So it's true that fewer people get stuffy noses and coughs in the summer, but cold weather itself does not cause colds. It's not just about seasonality. The other factor is our behavior, experts say. Nice weather means people are opening windows and gathering outside where it's harder for germs to spread. But respiratory viruses are still around. When the weather gets too hot and everyone heads inside for the air conditioning, doctors say they start seeing more sickness. In places where it gets really hot for a long time, summer can be cold season in its own right. I grew up in the East Coast and everybody gets sick in the winter, said Dr. Frank Lovecchio, an emergency room doctor and Arizona State University researcher. A lot of people get sick in the summer here. Why is that? Because you spend more time indoors. Question: should you get a COVID-19 booster now? Answer: for people who are otherwise healthy, timing is a key consideration to getting any vaccine. If you want to get it in a few weeks before that big trip or wedding, if that's the reason for getting boosted, doctors say. But for most people, it may be worth waiting until the fall in anticipation of winter cases for COVID-19 really tick up. You want to be fully protected at the time that it's most important for you, said Dr. Kosti Sifri of the University of Virginia's health system. People at high risk of complications should always talk with their doctor about what is best for them, Sifri added. Older adults and those with weak immune systems may need more boosters than others, he said. Question: are more tots getting sick with COVID-19? Answer: last week, the CDC noted emergency room visits among children younger than 4 were rising. That makes sense, Bloomberg said, because many young kids are getting it for the first time or are unvaccinated. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said in May that the shots would no longer be recommended for healthy kids, a decision that health experts have said lacks scientific basis. The American Academy of Pediatrics still endorses COVID-19 shots for children older than 6 months. Question: how else can I lower my risk? Answer: the same things that help prevent colds, flu, and COVID at any time of the year work in the summer, doctors say. Spend time outside when you can, wash your hands, wear a mask, and if you're sick, stay home. Now we'll pause the broadcast reading for a reminder that you're listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I am a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sunsound is also available on your smart home device. We'll continue with the next article from the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star. The title of the first article from the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star is Wards 3, 5, and 6 City Council Primary Tuesday. This article was written by Charles Brola of the Arizona Daily Star. Tucson Democrats will have their say Tuesday in three primary races for Tucson City Council. Democratic voters in Tucson's Ward 3 will decide between incumbent Kevin Dahl and challenger Sadie Shaw. The winner will face Republican Janet J.L. Wittenbrecker in November's general election. In Ward 5, voters will choose between Democrats Selena Barayas, Chris Elsner, and Jesse Lugo. Since no Republican is running in Ward 5, the primary winner will take the seat, barring the unlikely successful challenge by a write-in candidate in the general election. In Ward 6, voters will take their pick between Democrats Leighton Rockefeller Jr., Miranda Schubert, and Jim Sinex. Republican Jay Tokoff will face the primary winner in November. Voters can go to recorder.pima.gov/voter_dashboard_login to check their registration or the status of their mail-in ballot using the Pima County's Recorder's Office new voter dashboard. On Monday, Tucson voters can drop off their ballot or receive and vote a replacement ballot from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Tucson City Clerk Election Center at 800 East 12th Street near South Euclid Avenue and East Broadway. Three drop-off-only locations will be available to voters Monday, and they are from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Pima County Recorder's Office downtown, 240 North Stone Avenue, or the Recorder's Office Election Department location at 6550 South Country Club Road near East Valencia and South Country Club Roads. From 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., the Recorder's Office's east side location at 6920 East Broadway near South Cope Road will also be available for voters for ballot drop-off. The east side location will be closed Monday from noon to 1 p.m. Ballots can be dropped off Tuesday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. at all three locations. One voting location will be available Monday. From 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., voters can go to Tucson City Clerk's Election Center at 800 East 12th Street. That location will be also open from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. Tuesday. Three additional voting locations will be available from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. Tuesday. Donna Liggins Recreation Center, 2160 North 6th Street, or rather North 6th Avenue. And the El Pueblo Senior Center at 101 West Irvington Road. Also, Parks and Recreation Administration Building at Reed Park, 900 South Randolph Way. The Recorder's Office sent a total of 91,357 mail-in ballots for the primary. Some 19,083 ballots had been returned by Thursday, officials say. One of the mail-in ballots returned so far, all but about 25 of them were already turned over to the Elections Department, according to the Recorder's Office. The next article is titled, Arts Grants Given Out in Nick of Time. This article was written by Catalina E. Birch of the Arizona Daily Star. The Arts Foundation for Tuesday in Southern Arizona doled out more than $850,000 in grants in April, just weeks before the National Endowment for the Arts attempted to rescind the funding. It was a second phase of the foundation's $1.4 million ARPA artist and organization grant programs funded in 2021 through City of Tucson and NEA American Rescue Plan Act's grants. In December 2023, the Arts Foundation distributed the first rounds of grants totaling more than $540,000. The foundation's timing turned out to be fortuitous, said Gabriela Munoz, the foundation's director of grants and programs. It received a letter from the NEA on May 2nd that rescinded the foundation's $500,000 ARPA grant. Arts organizations around the country were receiving similar notices that threatened to rescind or withdraw grants that did not align with President Donald Trump's agenda. Such grants included those fostering AI competency, empowering houses of worship to serve communities, assisting with disaster recovery, and supporting tribal and Asian American communities. The letter did not mention the Arts Foundation's two other NEA grants for $75,000 each. The NEA, which is responsible for distributing public arts funding, did not say what would happen to grants that were already spent. The Arts Foundation 2023 grants went to reimburse 43 artists and 41 arts and cultural organizations from 16 cities and towns throughout southern Arizona that had funded their projects out of pocket. Munoz was part of the urgency she and the Arts Foundation CEO Adriana Gallego had in distributing the funding. We had made our original contract already, so we were so relieved that our community would be able to benefit from these public dollars, Munoz said. Some of the projects from the ARPA Artists and Organization grant programs included the Gila Valley Arts Council's music education program that served nearly 200 adults and more than 600 students from a dozen schools in the Graham County community, and Odaiko Sonora Rhythm Industry used its grant money to pay artists and administrators to work with students aged 10 to 80 on everything from team building to performing in Tucson's annual All Souls Procession. A pilot program established by Pakwa Yaki, tribal member, to help tribal businesses navigate the tech world and improve their profile. Eli Barron taught songwriting on an underserved population at long-term Tucson medical care residence. Tucson-based American Literary Translators Association used the funds to keep its program director, who continued the organization's popular online multilingual workshops and online pitch sessions. The Arts Foundation said 70% of its 43 artist grantees received their first-ever grants and served from 389 families and 82 healthcare and frontline workers. The sheer impact of numbers of families served, artists hired, Munoz said. 41 organizations that we supported turned around and hired 366 artists in their own communities. You think about all the impact of these households and the impact of the service and bringing people together. We were just so delighted to be able to issue the money and support all of our grantees. The next article from the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star is titled, Migrant Cases Decline in State. This article was written by Richard Rulers of the Arizona Republic. The number of people charged with immigration-related crimes in Arizona federal courts has plummeted during the past 2 months, and July ended as the slowest month for prosecutions yet. The numbers come from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Arizona, which in March stated releasing weekly prosecution statistics. The releases detail a number of cases for two types of immigration crimes, illegal entry, a misdemeanor, and re-entry following a prior removal, a felony. The numbers show a steep drop-off in July compared to the high levels in April and May. New cases filed in July were roughly half of previous weeks. The slowdown has meant the number of new criminal cases is below the average weekly total during the same quarters in 2024 when Joe Biden was president. The drop-off comes just past the midpoint of the first year of President Donald Trump's second term, a year in which his administration vowed the largest deportation effort in the country's history. The deportation goal for 2025 was 1 million people. While new criminal cases were filed by U.S. Attorney's Office have declined, statistics released by Immigration and Customs Enforcement show no let-up in the number of people that agency has detained. People held in the ICE facilities are awaiting their removal proceedings in immigration court. Though hearings are held in courtroom in front of a judge, they are administrative. It is not a criminal court. People accused of crimes are held in the custody of the U.S. Marshals Service, and their cases are heard in federal courtrooms. After their criminal trial, they would transfer to ICE custody and face civil removal proceedings. But with a decline in prosecutions and the ICE population holding steady, it means a greater number of people went straight into ICE custody and civil removal proceedings. They did not face criminal prosecution, either because there was nothing to charge them with or because prosecutors chose not to press a case. Timothy Corchin, a U.S. attorney for the District of Arizona, declined to interview requests to discuss a drop-off in criminal prosecutions. Robert McWhirter, an attorney who has practiced immigration law for 30 years, said the plummeting numbers were surprising. Even what he understood was pressure for prosecutors to produce more felony cases. McWhirter said he's heard from prosecutors that are receiving memos instructing them to try to up their numbers. Besides fodder for news releases, McWhirter said prosecutors will have a practical reason to charge as many people as possible with felonies as it expedites their removal from the United States. Anybody with a felony, and especially an immigration felony, is low-hanging fruit for the government, McWhirter said. Like all crimes, law enforcement must show evidence in court to justify the charge. Bringing a federal charge of illegal entry, a misdemeanor, requires that a Border Patrol agent actually witness someone cross the border illegally, or that the person confesses to an illegal crossing. For a felony re-entry charge, an ICE agent would search a database and find that the person previously was removed from the country and absent a record showing they had permission to enter. The immigrant's mere presence in the United States would suffice to bring that charge. A drop in prosecutions for felony re-entry would indicate that either ICE agents were finding more people who were caught for the first time, or that prosecutors were showing an unusual amount of leniency. Noel Rascon, who has practiced public defense in federal court since 2021, said he doubted prosecutors were taking it easy on migrants. I don't see any indication of that, he said. Through the U.S. Attorney's Office declined an interview request, the acting public affairs officer for the Arizona office, Esther Nguyen, said she believed the decline showed that enforcement is working. She said in an email that as the border is secured and laws are enforced, we should expect that fewer cases will be presented for prosecution. Trump took office with tough talk of going after public safety threats. People he describes as criminals and thugs loose on the streets of the United States. Officials posted videos and commercials of arrests of tattooed men they said were gang members. In April, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem invited media outlets to tag along as she joined agents in Phoenix while they arrested people she described as dirtbags. But according to statistics produced by ICE, its agents are increasingly not arresting people with criminal histories or were accused of crimes. Instead, they are busting people whose sole offense is being in this country illegally. ICE agents patrol the interior of the country, including metro areas such as Phoenix. ICE arrests involve hours of surveillance and as many as a dozen agents. Todd Lyons, the acting director of the agency, said in an April meeting with reporters in Phoenix. Some ICE operations in the Phoenix area have been filmed by relatives, activists, and journalists. Vehicles line residential streets. A small army of masked agents patrolled with rifles drawn. A February arrest in northwest Phoenix saw an armored vehicle with a battering ram drive near the front door of a house. Agents deployed flashbangs and ordered a man out of the home. That man, Alfonso Vega, was charged with felony reentry. He pleaded guilty in March and was sentenced July 10th to 6 months in prison, including the time he had already served since February. After that, he will be transferred to a detention facility for a civil deportation case. With a felony conviction, his deportation is all but assured. By contrast, in June, a woman in Chandler was arrested near a home by multiple ICE agents and an agent from the FBI, according to court records. The woman who was a target of arrest by ICE agents is facing only civil removal proceedings. The arrest was noted in court documents because U.S. citizens, relatives of the woman, chased after the agents. They were arrested. The relatives will face the judge in handcuffs and leg irons. The woman ICE agent arrested will attend a civil proceedings unshackled. ICE increases arrests of non-criminal immigrants in Arizona. An increasing number of people arrested by ICE agents were not convicted criminals or stood accused of committing a crime, the agency's statistics show. The nationwide statistics released by ICE, which are mandated by Congress, delineate between three types of offenders. In one category are people whose only crimes were related to being in the country illegally, including felony reentry. The other categories are people who were previously committed, or rather convicted, of something else, anything from murder to drunken driving, that wasn't related to their immigration status, or they were facing charges for a non-immigration crime. The immigration authorities were concentrating on people without criminal histories, was mentioned in a federal court filing. A Homeland Security investigation agent in a July 30 document described working with ICE agents on targeted operations in relation to administrative immigration enforcement, not criminal violators. An ICE spokesman, Yasmin Pitts O'Keefe, said in an email that ICE agents conduct actions on both criminal and administrative law violations with public safety threats continuing as a priority. She did not directly address a question about the special agent's mention of an operation solely devoted to administrative violations. That operation found a man who had been removed from the country previously, prompting a felony charge for reentry. It would be counted by the ICE statistics as immigration crime, distinct from other criminal charges. While ICE is detaining more people than the agency did under Biden, statistics show that under Trump, a greater number of those people had no convictions beyond immigration crimes. Austin Kocher, a Syracuse University professor who has specialized in studying immigration detention statistics, said the national numbers largely reflect the differences between policies under the two presidents. During the Biden administration, he said the number of non-criminal migrants was a sliver of those arrested. There were instructions to not go after people who did not have a criminal conviction, he said. The immigration attorney in Guerra said ICE at that time would concentrate on picking someone up after they were released from prison or jail after a felony arrest. A guy out there of status gets picked up in a DUI or a bar fight or domestic violence, he said. ICE gets noticed and sends a couple of agents. The person ICE arrested coming out of prison would add to the statistics of those who had a criminal record. The person that ICE arrested coming out of the jail, presuming they were awaiting trial, would have their charges pending. That's the most efficient way to do it, McWhorter said. Local law enforcement becomes a force multiplier for ICE. While criminal arrests have declined, ICE almost exclusively highlights those on social media. The agency's enforcement and removal office page on X has posted photos and brief criminal histories of people arrested. Most had a criminal history in the United States, meaning they would show up among statistics of criminals held in ICE custody. The post would have included a grab bag of crimes. Two men were wanted in Mexico. One was a cartel member, the post said, while another was an MS-13 gang member. Four men previously were convicted of sexual crimes, three of them involving minors. Another man was convicted of less serious crime, shoplifting. Kocher said such posts are curated to perpetrate the narrative that ICE was deporting dangerous criminals. But, he said, those posts don't accurately reflect the backgrounds of most who are detained. If they actually tweeted out the people they're arresting and deport in the appropriate proportion, Kocher said, for every one of those, they would have 5 million people like Jose, who has no criminal history and works in a kitchen. Now it's time to flip the pages to the Nation and the World section of the Arizona Daily Star, to check out several important news articles there. The first article is titled Russian Oil Depot Hit. This article came from the Associated Press. An overnight Ukrainian drone attack on an oil depot near Russia's Black Sea resort of Sochi sparked a major fire, Russian officials said Sunday, as the two countries traded strikes and the Ukrainian president announced a prisoner exchange. More than 120 firefighters tried to extinguish the blaze sparked after debris from a downed drone struck a fuel tank, Krasnodar regional governor Vinamin Kantiev said on Telegram. Videos on social media appear to show huge pillars of smoke billowing above the oil depot. Russia's civil aviation authority, Rosaviatsiya, temporarily stopped flights at Sochi's airport. Further north, authorities in the Voronezh region reported that four people were wounded in another Ukrainian drone attack. Russia's defense ministry said its air defenses shot down 93 Ukrainian drones over Russia and the Black Sea overnight into Sunday. Meanwhile, in southern Ukraine, a Russian missile strike hit a residential area in the city of Mykolaiv, according to the state emergency services, wounding seven people. The Ukrainian Air Force said Sunday that Russia launched 76 drones and seven missiles against Ukraine. It said 60 drones and one missile were intercepted, but 16 others and six missiles hit targets across eight locations. The reciprocal attacks came at the end of one of the deadliest weeks in Ukraine in recent months, after a Russian drone and missile attack on Thursday killed 31 people, including five children, and wounded over 150. The continued attacks come after U.S. President Donald Trump gave on Tuesday Russia President Vladimir Putin a shorter deadline, August 8th, for peace efforts to make progress. Trump said Thursday that Special Envoy Steve Witkoff is heading to Russia to push Moscow to agree to a ceasefire in its war with Ukraine and has threatened new economic sanctions if progress is not made. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Sunday that Ukraine and Russia agreed to exchange 1,200 prisoners following their latest round of negotiations in Istanbul in July. There is an agreement to exchange 1,200 people, he wrote on X, saying that the lists of individuals to be swapped were being worked on and they are working to unblock the return of our civilians. There was no immediate comment from Russia. Zelensky also said he discussed with top Ukrainian officials the negotiation track, specifically the implementations of the agreements reached during the meetings with the Russian side in Istanbul, as well as preparations for a new meeting. Each of the three rounds of talks between countries this year has resulted in prisoner exchanges, but yielded no breakthrough in reaching a ceasefire. The title of our next article is Pope Leo XIV, A Different World is Possible. This article was written by Colleen Berry and Paolo Santalucia of the Associated Press, Dateline Rome. Pope Leo XIV on Sunday told more than a million Catholic youths at a closing mass for a week-long encounter with the next generation of faithful that they are the sign that a different world is possible, where conflicts can be resolved with dialogue, not weapons. In his closing blessings for the Jubilee of Youth, Leo remembered the young people of Gaza and Ukraine and other countries at war who could not join the celebration. "We are closer than ever to young people who suffer the most serious evils, which are caused by other human beings," Leo said. "We are with the young people of Gaza. We are with the young people of Ukraine, whose every land bloodied by war. My young brothers and sisters, you are the sign that a different world is possible, a world of fraternity and friendship, where conflicts are not resolved with weapons but with dialogue." The young people camped out in sprawling fields southeast of Rome overnight after attending a vigil service on Saturday, also presided by Leo, who has been ferried from Vatican City by helicopter. The special Jubilee celebration is part of the Holy Year that is expected to draw 32 million people to the Vatican for the centuries-old pilgrimage to the seat of Catholicism. The Vatican said more than 1 million young people were present along with 7,000 priests and 450 bishops. During the Sunday homily, Leo urged the participants to spread your enthusiasm and the witness of your faith when they return home to some 150 countries. Aspire to great things, to holiness, wherever you are. Leo urged the young faithful, do not settle for less. You will then see the light of the gospel growing every day in you and around you. Leo reminded the crowd that the next encounter will be during World Youth Day, set for August 3rd and 8th through 8th, 2027 in Seoul, South Korea. The week has been joyous gathering, marked by bands of youth singing hymns as they move down cobblestone streets, praying the rosary in piazzas and standing for hours at the Circus Maximus to confess their sins to priests offering the sacraments in a dozen languages. Leo also shared some tragic news on Saturday. Two young people who made the pilgrimage to Rome had died, one reportedly of cardiac arrest, while a third was hospitalized. Rain overnight awakened the faithful but didn't dampen their spirits. At least we were a little covered and we still got a bit wet. We lost our voices a little, it was cold, but we woke up to a beautiful sun and view, said Soemel Rios, 20, from Puerto Rico. Despite the difficulties, it was very nice and very special to have been part of this historic moment. Sister Giulia De Luco from Rome acknowledged that waking up was a bit tough, but that she was looking forward to seeing the Pope again. It will be very nice to conclude a very intense week together. Definitely a lot of fun, but also very challenging in many ways, she said. The next article is titled OPEC Plus Countries to Increase Oil Production in September. This article is from the Associated Press, Dateline, New York. A group of countries that are part of the OPEC Plus Alliance of oil-exporting countries agreed Sunday to boost oil production, a move some believe could lower oil and gasoline prices, citing a steady global economic outlook and low oil inventories. The group met virtually and announced that eight of its member countries would increase oil production by 547,000 barrels per day in September. The countries boosting output, Saudi Arabia, Russia, Iraq, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Kazakhstan, Algeria, and Oman, were participating on involuntary production cuts initially made in November 2023 that were scheduled to be phased out by September 2026. The announcement means the voluntary production cuts will end ahead of schedule. When production increases, oil and gasoline prices may fall, but Brent crude oil, which is considered a global benchmark, has been trading near $70 per barrel, which could be due to a potential loss of Russian oil on the market and a large increase in crude inventories in China, according to research firm Clearview Energy Partners. President Trump has not obviously relented from his threat to sanction Russian energy if the Kremlin does not reach a peace deal with Ukraine as of August 7th, potentially via secondary tariffs on buyers, Clearview Energy Partners said in an analyst note Sunday. The eight countries will meet again on September 7th, OPEC said in a news release. And now an article from the business section of the Arizona Daily Star. Trump pushes for deregulation. This article was written by Kathy Busowitz of the Associated Press. The U.S. Department of Labor aims to rewrite or repeal more than 60 obsolete workplace regulations, ranging from minimum wage requirements for home health care workers and people with disabilities to standards governing exposure to harmful substances. If approved, the wide-ranging changes unveiled in recent days also would affect working conditions at the construction sites and in mines, and limit the government's ability to penalize employers if workers are injured or killed while engaged in inherently risky activities. The Labor Department says the goal is to reduce costly, burdensome rules imposed under previous administrations and to deliver on President Donald Trump's commitment to restore American prosperity through deregulation. Critics say the proposals would put workers at greater risk of harm, with women and members of minority groups bearing a disproportionate impact. People are at very great risk of dying on the job already, Rebecca Rindle, the AFL-CIO union's occupational safety and health director said. This is something that is only going to make the problem worse. The proposed changes have several stages to get through before they can take effect, including a public comment period. Here's a look at a few of the rollbacks under considerations. First, no minimum wage for home health care workers. Home health care workers help elderly or medically fragile people by preparing meals, administrating medications, assisting with toilet use, accompanying claims to doctor appointments, and performing other tasks. Under one of the Labor Department's proposal, an estimated 3.7 million workers employed by home care agencies could be paid below the federal minimum wage, currently $7.25 per hour, and made ineligible for overtime pay if they weren't covered by corresponding state laws. The proposed rule would reverse changes made in 2013 under former President Barack Obama's and revert to a regulatory framework from 1975. The next element, protections from migrant farm workers. Last year, the Labor Department finalized rules that provided protections to migrant farm workers who held H-2A visas. The current administration says most of those rules place unnecessarily and costly requirements on employers. Under the new proposal, the Labor Department would rescind a requirement for most employers to provide transportation to have seat belts for those workers. The department also proposed a reverse of the 2024 rule that protected migrant farm workers from retaliation for activities such as filing a complaint. There's a long history of retaliation against workers who speak up against abuses in farm work. Due to time constraints, this article has been abridged. Also, due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star, the Monday, August 4th, 2025 edition. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.